Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a beautiful Sunday morning, isn't it? It's especially beautiful after having your door slammed in your face by Clinton. That'll wake you up. That'll get you going. Woo-hoo! I'm ready and fired up now to discuss addiction. Is that, I think Clinton's addicted to slamming that door because he does it at least once a week. I don't know how he does it with the rest of his family, but he does it here with me at the WPVC family. We'll be talking about addiction with our guest today, Kyle Austin. Kyle's the executive director of Charlottesville's Addiction Recovery Systems here on the Pantops area. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you for having me.
A little closer.
All right.
I'll there get closer. You go. I like that. Get addicted to that thing. I'm not going to make any more jokes about that. But reduce the aura. Get comfortable with that microphone. Addiction, because it's an important, you know, and the reason that we're doing this is there was an article I had Lisa Province on 2 weeks ago from Sevo Weekly. I think in the same issue, or certainly in the issue the week after, there was an article that was written about a young woman who had passed away from heroin, and her obituary, her mother wanted her obituary printed with addiction being the cause of death, and the Daily Progress wouldn't print it that way. And the images that come to my mind are this is a topic we don't discuss about. This is one of those under the radar issues. Unless you listen to national news, I'm thinking, you know what? I hear this. I hear opioids discussed every day on the way to work with NPR. Mm-hmm. But so let's discuss it here at WPVC. We're going to do that today with Kyle. So Kyle, I want you to lead me for question number one. When you talk about addiction, where do we start with this? Do you start with what it is? Who has it? Is it a disease? Is it a choice? You know, where do you start the conversation?
We can start from any number of different points. First, I'd like to say that, you know, as evidenced by that article that you just discussed, by the shows that you're talking about in the national news and NPR, it is a public health crisis. So I think that's really the conversation starter for us, is that addiction, and particularly with regard to opiates and heroin, this is a public health crisis. It's affecting millions and millions of people around the country. And it's definitely something that we should be talking about more and not attempting to hide.
So you are saying, and I'm going to ask you to do this because you brought this up with me outside. And unless you tell me differently, and unless you tell the listeners differently, this is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville here, Sunday morning wake-up call, that you're representing Addiction Recovery Systems. Addiction Recovery Systems does what?
We treat primarily opiate-dependent individuals with medication-assisted treatment using methadone and Suboxone.
So when we talk about a topic, when we talk about, when I ask questions and you give an answer, I'm going to assume that these are, this is knowledge, these are answers given through you that would be given by ARS, unless you tell me differently.
I'll specify when it's my opinion. A lot of my knowledge and experience does come through my affiliation with ARS. And I love the work I do. I love the company that I work for, but I am going to be very specific when I'm talking my own opinions.
Okay. So back to what you were saying, which is, it sounds like that you and ARS are saying that that the addiction, at least to opioids, this is a health problem, not a choice? Because that seems to be one of the major breaks in the discussion amongst the American public. Is this is not a health issue in terms of those who are suffering from this problem. It's not a health problem in terms of a DNA issue or those who have a problem because, you know, their body is, it's a choice. You're making the choice. Don't ask me to feel sorry for you for suffering from it.
I would not agree with that assessment in terms of it being a choice. You know, the brain, just like every other organ in the body, is an organ of the body. It functions pretty well for all of humanity. And if you pull the average human, they're going to have a pretty well-functioning brain. With neurotransmitters working, all the neurons are firing appropriately. However, when we look at people, and when we look particularly at people with the disease, and I will call it that, the disease of addiction, what you see when you look at the brains of people with the disease of addiction is that they function differently, that there is a massive biological component in this disease. So when you talk about choice, that to me seems somewhat reductive. Yes, you know, the individual appears to make a choice to use drugs, but when you're addicted, your brain's not really giving you a choice.
Do you know, or does the health world know how the American public is, what the percentage of the public break is on this? Those who feel that it is a health addiction versus those who feel that it is a mental choice?
I can't give you specific numbers on that. What I can say is that we are seeing, I think, a lot of progress, particularly in the last few years, with looking at disease as an addiction as a disease. If you look just in the past few weeks, Barack Obama, the president, has come out pretty forcefully saying that addiction is a disease, it's a medical condition, and we are not going to arrest our way out of this problem. We need to treat it as a health condition. And if you look kind of worldwide at other countries and then how they're handling addiction, the countries that have treated it as a disease, have treated it as a medical condition, are seeing what I would say are better outcomes.
Do we know what percentage of drug overdoses come from addiction? Again, I go back to the young woman whose article sort of sparked me tracking down a guest for today's topic. Is it an addiction that leads to someone misusing heroin or any other drug? Is it someone who's misusing it the first time or the second time? You know, explain that to me.
So it can be a first time occurrence. An accidental misuse of a substance leads to an overdose. What you're going to see more often is that its addiction is progressive, and that it progresses to that point where someone overdoses. The way that addiction works, and particularly with opiates and heroin, is, you know, you start out with that single use. You may be out with friends or just trying something at a party or something along those lines, and you get that initial rush of endorphins and relaxed feelings, and everything feels pretty good. And then, you know, you want to try, if you decide to use it again, and we see that a lot of people who use one time don't necessarily go on to use consistently afterwards. But for those who do, when you keep seeking that high, it takes more and more of the drug in question to achieve the high that you first experienced. And so we get up into what we call the effective dose and the toxic dose. And as you increase your use of the substances, it takes more and more to get that high. You get much closer to the toxic dose, which can lead to overdose.
the effective dose versus the toxic dose.
Yeah.
Does that, I mean, I'm assuming just because we're people of different sizes and shapes and genetic makeup, that that changes. It's different for everyone.
Absolutely.
And because it's a pharmaceutical, at least in the case of heroin or opioids, which sounds like that's what we're talking about now.
Right. So the prescription pain medications.
Right. That's different. That's not, we're not copying that every time. People aren't getting the exact same percentage makeup to this time versus tomorrow, and my dosage versus your dosage, or the next, or our neighbor's dosage. So it changes.
It does. It changes from person to person. So particularly with the prescription pain medications, which are given out from everything from dental pain to following up on major surgeries, things along those lines. You know, if both of us go in for a dental operation, the pain medication that they give me in terms of the milligrams and how many times a day I'm supposed to take it would probably be very different for you, just because our biological makeup is different. What's effective for me in terms of pain medication to treat a pain problem would be different for anybody else.
Now, you answered this, but because it's early in the show and we're getting settled again. This is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're talking about addiction today. Kyle Austin is the executive director at Charlottesville's Addiction Recovery Systems. You said that ARS here in Charlottesville works mostly with...
Almost exclusively with people who are addicted to heroin and prescription pain medications, opiates.
How many people... I mean, how many people are we talking about here? Charlottesville's a good old, you know, mostly southern town, and those who aren't southern are good upper class academics who've come down to go to school here.
I hear you. So
we're talking about five people?
We have had a census of between really 200 and 450 for as long as I can remember, and we are not.
How many?
200 and 450.
I have to write that down, because if I don't see it, I'm not sure I'll remember it because of disbelief.
And we could go higher, is the honest truth. That's the nature of this epidemic. And I said earlier in the show that we are facing a public health epidemic. That is something that the governor, the attorney general, they have all recognized this as a public health epidemic. The president of the United States has recognized this as a public health epidemic. And I said earlier that it's important that we talk about it, that we bring it into the light so that we can best deal with it and help the individuals and the families who struggle with addiction. I hear you when you say that Charlottesville is a good old southern town, and we've got the University of Virginia and a ton of professionals who live here. And I'll tell you that because this is a public health epidemic, some of those people that we just talked about may be facing this issue, either themselves or in their families. It's a huge problem, and it's kind of hidden at this point. People do a lot to try and hide it.
How do you spot it? I mean, if I'm, whether it's a family member, whether it's a coworker, if it's today's conversation with you, if it's the radio articles that I'm hearing on NPR, if it's the 60 Minutes show, the Washington Post, the Seville Weekly, whoever we want to discuss that's putting more emphasis on the problem and enlightening us that it's the stereotype is changing and enlarging, you know, growing greater, encompassing a larger number of people of all types. Yeah. How do I identify who's there? Because my heart is growing and willing to help a larger number of folks.
Yeah. So with any disease, we're going to see physical components and we're going to see behavioral components. So in terms of the disease of addiction, you would be looking for what we call, as we call them, withdrawal symptoms. And these are going to differ depending on what drug of abuse that we're talking about, but you'll see differences in the state of consciousness, differences in the ability of people to speak with you, stand up, walk, keep a steady gait. You'll see differences in skin tone and whether maybe they're sweating profusely. The eyes, the pupils can refuse to dilate. They can be super dilated. So we see all these physical symptoms, but there's also behavioral components as well. And especially in the disease of addiction, the nature of the disease is that the substance that's being abused and that people, you know, may be becoming dependent on really takes over their life. They'll pull back from relationships, pull back from activities that they've always been interested in because more and more of their time is spent seeking out this substance, making connections so that they can get whatever these substances are that they're addicted to. It really takes over.
At ARS, again, Kyle Austin here, a director at Addiction Recovery System here in Charlottesville. The folks who have reached the stage of need for help, mm-hmm. are these folks coming to you? Are they seeking self-help? Is the family sending them? Are they court appointed your way?
So a lot of our patients are coming because they've recognized or a family member has recognized, all right, we need some sort of treatment. We need some sort of help. And the best way that these patients have decided is to go ahead and get involved in our treatment program. Now, there are a ton of different treatment programs. There's medication-assisted treatment. There are methadone and Suboxone providers throughout the state of Virginia and throughout the United States. There's inpatient treatment, which I'm sure you've heard of, where you go and you know, you may be detoxed from whatever substance it is that you're on for 30 to 60 to 90 days. There's counseling where there's no medication and no detox, but you're going in and you're having face-to-face contact with a therapist and a counselor. But yeah, it's really family members at ARS and the actual patients who have decided, I need to turn this around. And they take that first initial step to come and get involved in our program where they're overseen by a doctor, regular contact with nurses and medical staff, counseling staff, group counseling, and then referrals to other services as needed.
Can you be addicted even if you only use once in a while? I mean, because for most people, I think that, again, the stereotype is that someone who's an addict uses multiple times a day or certainly daily, is always hunting for your next dose and the money to buy the next dose. Can you be a true addict? Can you suffer from an addiction if you don't need to use it daily, but you need to use it again at some point? You're in the circumstance. Mm-hmm. You're with these people. You see it on TV.
Yeah. So what I think you're getting at is the difference between physical dependence and this more colloquial term of addict. To me, an addict is anyone who recognizes that they have a relationship with a substance that they might not be able to control, whether they're using it daily, whether they're managing to keep it, you know, once every week, once every month, but you know, when they do it, they're not able to control the relationship with the substance. Now, in terms of physical dependence, yes, those people are strongly addicted, meaning that they are needing to use the substance once a day, more than once a day, really to maintain equilibrium for their bodies and their selves. But in terms of an addict, many people in the community of addiction will call themselves addicts, but they haven't used for years. But it's because they recognize that they have an unhealthy relationship with the substance, wherein if they were to pick up a beer again, or if they were to be in a place where they could use heroin, they know that they wouldn't be able to control themselves.
Following that definition, can addiction be inherited?
Yes. Genetically, you can gain a predisposition to addiction. So if you look at families, if you have an immediate family member, a grandparent, a parent, brother, sister, someone who shares a lot of the same genes as you, that genetic predisposition can get passed on to you, and you can have a higher likelihood of becoming addicted yourself.
Sunday morning wake up call here, 11:20. Our guest, Kyle Austin, as we talk about addiction. Please hang on. Kyle Austin here with us. He's the executive director, Charlottesville's Addiction Recovery Systems. He knows a lot about addiction because he helps people with addiction. Kyle, any background in there? Because you often see folks who, whether they're doing the, whether they're leading the group, when you're having the face-to-face conversations, whether they're on the street trying to gain the trust of the folks on the street, they often seem to be the folks who have the background. They've, you know, I've gone through this. Let me show you how you can break your addiction.
I personally don't like to share, you know, whether I've ever been addicted to a substance or whether I'm addicted to a substance. And the reason that I say that is because I think it's important for our patients at Addiction Recovery Systems and patients in addiction treatment in general to be able to meet with anybody, any treatment professional, and be able to see them as a legitimate person who can help them achieve their goals, in their treatment program. Now what I think you're talking about, and I know that they have this at various places in Virginia, up in Baltimore, is this profession of peer recovery specialists. And what that is individuals who do identify as addicts, quote unquote, who have a history of addiction and who are in recovery, actively working on their own recovery, in recovery, and going out and helping people, kind of the way that you said. I've been through this. I understand it on an intimate level because I suffer that same relationship that I know that I wouldn't be able to control. And, you know, let me help you, because it seems like you're still in that lack of control area of the relationship.
What do you think about, you know, I when I opened the program, I talked about sort of what prompted me to put today's hour together. The young woman in Charlottesville who passed away from a heroin overdose. Mm-hmm. Her mother attempted to put her obituary in Charlottesville's Daily Progress newspaper by listing heroin overdose as the cause of death. The Daily Progress would not accept that because I guess it was too, it wasn't nice enough.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to list that. It wasn't clean enough for our nice southern town readership.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts? What's ARS thoughts on that in terms of...
So I'm not going to give ARS's opinion on this one. I'm happy to talk about my personal thoughts. Overall, I'm not a newspaper editor. I can't make those decisions. Not educated in that area. What I know about the disease of addiction is that when someone begins to become addicted, one of the first things that we see as addiction treatment professionals is that they're going to try and hide it, and they're going to try and deny that it's an issue. And then when it finally gets so extreme that the family becomes aware of it and the family knows that there's something going on, that there may be an addiction issue in place, then the family oftentimes does the exact same thing. They try to deny that it's an issue and they try to hide that it's an issue. And I think that to a degree, as a community, as in a society, we're still stuck in one in that issue that we see that's really a prominent issue with addiction, is that we're always trying to deny that it's an issue and we're always trying to hide that it's out there and it's affecting our friends and our family and our communities. I would say the more coverage that we can give to this, the more that we can put a human face on it, the more that we can defeat, like you said earlier in the show, this idea that there's a stereotypical user and there's a stereotypical addict. Those are ideas that we need to defeat, because ultimately it's not helping the people who are addicted, who come from all walks of life.
So Kyle Austin, someone who helps people who are addicts, regardless of the business that he works for, but whose job is helping addicts, says that he believes it would be more helpful if any and all newspapers would print an honest cause of death if it were heroin overdose, because that in some instances would be more helpful to the general public and enlightening others, enlightening the rest of us.
I don't know about all that. I can say that, that's a family decision. A lot of times it's a family's decision first, then it's the editor's decision.
But when the family does this, when the family's okay with it, that's all that, that's enough.
I think that it presents a unique opportunity to a newspaper, be it the Daily Progress, the Seville Weekly. I think it presents a unique opportunity to bring attention to the issue that the community faces. It's an opportunity to put a face on it, to say, this was a human being with hopes and dreams and skills, and friends and family who cared about her. And whether this is a surprise or not, she suffered from addiction. I think it presents a unique opportunity to show that this can really honestly happen to anyone.
Well done. Kyle Austin, Executive Director of Charlottesville's Addiction Recovery System here in Charlottesville. We're talking today about addiction on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is the Sunday morning wake-up call, 11:28. Thanks for tuning in. Does gender or age play a role in addiction? I'd read in several places that the earlier you tried it, the more likely you were to be an addict.
So there is some truth to that statement. If you look at your average human being, neurologically, they are developing their brain, the organ. Again, I'm going to go back to the organ of the brain, is developing all the way up until the mid-20s. Brain development might cease as early as, 23, 24, and might go on for as late as 26, even 27 in some cases. But most people, average person, is going to have brain development going on until 25. When you start use of a substance early on in life, the brain recognizes, oh, I'm getting this substance, so I don't need to devote as many resources to whatever that substance is giving me. As humans, we can't really become addicted to anything our brain doesn't already make. So heroin releases endorphins. Nicotine and other drugs do a lot of release of this chemical called dopamine, which is called the pleasure chemical. It's very difficult for us to get addicted to things that our brain doesn't already make. In terms of early onset use, early onset recreational use, early onset regular use of a substance, the brain is doing a lot of development. It's taken up a lot of energy. It doesn't want to dedicate that energy to something that the child is already providing it. So it's not going to dedicate that energy to developing those systems, meaning that the child will continue or be more likely to have to continue giving whatever substance it is to the brain so that it functions normally.
But if you're, maybe I missed a step there. If you're 14 mm-hmm. and you're smoking pot or drinking beer or trying heroin, are you more likely to become an addict to any of those items than if you try them when you're 17?
So, yes, the earlier you are, the less developed the brain is. If you're looking at a 14-year-old, in terms of average brain development, their emotional regulation centers, their long-term planning centers, their self-control centers are not that well developed. Now, which is why you see with 14-year-olds and in the period of puberty, that there is a lot of emotional dysregulation. There is a lot of strong emotions at play, and it's because those centers of the brain that control emotional regulation haven't really developed yet. Moving on towards 17, the brain's had a lot more time to develop, and if you get up into 25, there's some evidence out there that non-regular recreational use of a substance won't do all that much damage to the brain, as long as you're not using it intensively those few times that you use it, because the brain has fully developed, is able to recognize what it needs to be doing.
Rick Moore here, Sunday morning wake-up call, 11:32, talking about addiction with Kyle Austin from Addiction Recovery System here in Charlottesville. Is marijuana truly the gateway drug? You know, we always hear about that, or certainly have.
That is popular...
Based on my age, you know, I always heard that in the past.
It's a popular statement. You hear it a lot, don't you?
Yes.
I'm going to say yes, and I'm going to say no, and I'm going to give more weight to my no answer. Which one do you want to hear first?
We'll go with yeah. We'll hear the yes answer first.
All right. So as you probably know, marijuana is illegal. It's scheduled by the government, and you are not allowed to go to a store and purchase it, much like you can go and purchase cigarettes or alcohol, correct?
Okay, yep, correct.
So what that means is if you or I wanted to go and get marijuana right now, who would we have to go to get it?
I'm not going to bum anybody out.
Yeah, we would have to.
I don't know.
We would have to go to a dealer.
30, 40 years ago, well, how old am I?
So we would have to go to a dealer in the community. And what you find with dealers in the community is that, you know, it's not usually just marijuana that they have access to in terms of selling.
Ah.
So in terms of a gateway, a literal gateway, if I'm going out to a dealer in the community and saying, you know, I want marijuana, the dealer might ask, well, do you want anything else? Because here are the other things that I have available.
All right. Let me open my notebook here and see what's in it.
Right. So in terms of a gateway, it does allow for exposure to other illicit substances that you can get out there in the community.
Interesting.
In terms of marijuana as a gateway drug, and my answer also being no, what you see is that many people in life have tried marijuana. If you look at the incidence of people who have tried marijuana, it's pretty high.
Bill Clinton.
I don't know of a president in my lifetime who hasn't tried marijuana. They've all been pretty open about it. Some even about cocaine use. The reason I say no is because if you look at all these people who have tried marijuana, the vast majority of them have not gone on to be what we would call addicts, or what the scientific community and the medical community would say are people with substance use disorder or substance dependence. The vast majority don't go on. So in terms of a gateway drug, it's not a very good gateway if it's not sending all these people, you know, down the road of addiction. And I like to kind of compare it to the another, you know, story that we hear in the media and in our cultural narrative, which is the violent video games. When we look at these horrible acts, shootings, horrible acts of violence around the country, there's often this media narrative that, well, that person played violent video games. Violent video games, you know, that must be the gateway into these violent acts. But if you look at the number of people who play violent video games and don't go on to do anything any other normal average person wouldn't do, again, it's not a gateway that leads down that road very effectively. So that's why I would give a lot more weight to my no answer with regard to marijuana, is because when I think of a gateway drug, I think of something that I've tried this, so now I'm also going to try this, this, and this. And we just simply don't see that with marijuana.
It's the person who's selling it who is the gateway.
Yes, because, quite literally.
Because they have other products in their pockets to sell.
Right. So I'm
interesting.
It's they have other things that they can offer, and I've been exposed to that if I'm going out and purchasing marijuana.
I'd never had it explained that way. I like that. 11:36 here on the Sunday morning wake up call. Kyle Austin with us talking about addiction. You know, so much conversation is being had these days, today, this hour, again, as well as in the news and this past year and even a few years before, has been on the opioids, the pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been the major change to addiction? The addiction has changed.
Absolutely.
From alcohol. Not that there are fewer alcoholics, but the publicity has changed from the addiction of other things to opioids.
Yeah, so if we look
at pharmaceutical issues.
Yeah, if we look at substance misuse, so using a substance the way you're not supposed to, be that using a prescription that's not yours, things along those lines, prescription pain medications and opiates have kind of rocketed to the forefront of the national stage and only trail alcohol and marijuana in terms of substances that are misused. In the period from 1999 to 2014, there was a fourfold increase in the number of purchases of these prescription pain medications. There was also a fourfold increase in overdoses related to that as well. It's become a massive problem.
I read in prepping for the show that drug overdose is now the leading cause of injury death in this country, more than gun deaths, more than car crashes.
I know that in Virginia last year, that was one of the major things that came out towards the end of the year, was that the number of overdoses had surpassed the number of car accidents.
Where do doctors fall into this? Because you... In doing my homework for today's show, there are certainly articles written, comments, complaints made that one of the reasons given for opioid addictions is that doctors write too many prescriptions and they're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem.
So, yeah, there is a lot of look at doctors right now. At the governmental level. So the CDC actually just last week, the Centers for Disease Control just last week came out with some pretty, I don't want to say strict, but very forward guidelines on the safe practices and prescribing opiates for pain management, for the management of long-term pain. And just perusing them, because that's all I was able to do last week, but in just perusing them, it looks like they are really pushing for better labeling of prescriptions, so that people are well aware this can lead to addiction. It's a high likelihood that this could lead to addiction if misused, as well as, you know, really strongly suggesting to doctors that they keep better track of their patients who are on these prescribed pain medications, and also that they're using non-pharmaceutical techniques to manage the pain as well, that they're making those recommendations, that prescription pain medications not be the main course of action in treating long-term pain.
What about health insurance companies? Does the health industry play a role in this in terms of basic pharmaceutical pills are rather inexpensive? And so, you know, it's easy to use those in terms mm-hmm. of going to get your prescription filled.
Where I would bring the healthcare industry and health insurance primarily into this discussion is doctor ratings. Interestingly enough, we now have, you know, Yelp and Google reviews for doctors. If I get onto my insurance portal today, I can go in and they'll have ratings of every doctor in their network that I can choose based on what patients are reporting. So if a patient, and if particularly someone who's doctor shopping, and we call that what it is, it's when someone with addiction is going to multiple different doctors seeking out prescriptions from all of them for pain medications because they're addicted to them. If a patient like that goes into a doctor's office seeking a prescription saying, you know, oh, I have chronic back pain or something along those lines, and the doctor says, well, I'm not going to prescribe you that, that doctor runs the risk then of potentially having a negative rating put on them. That patient is able to go on and give a negative rating to that doctor. So there's a bit of an impetus for doctors, and I'm not saying that doctors cave to this, but there is an impetus and a push for doctors to be more acquiescent to patient requests, which I don't think that's exactly how the medical community is supposed to work. I don't think that that's, best practice for the patient to really determine the treatment. But that does exist. And I think that that's where the health insurance industry comes in, is that they do doctor ratings and things along those lines.
I don't know that I don't want to get too much into this. 11:42 here on the Wake Up Call. We need to take a break because I don't know that you or I know this section of the topic well enough. But if I have chronic back pain and I've fulfilled my prescription from one doctor, mm-hmm. how does my health insurance allow me to go to doctor two and doctor three and doctor four, even if it is just via doctor shopping? How does that happen through my health insurance?
You would be surprised. People can call their insurance and say, my prescription got stolen. I lost my prescription. There's all sorts of stories that I've heard, that health insurance industries or health insurance companies may go along with.
All right, here we are today talking about addiction with Kyle Austin. He's the executive director of Charlottesville's Addiction Recovery System. Hang tight. All right, thanks for hanging out with us today. A great day to match up with what I think is a great show. Kyle Austin here with us as we're talking about addiction and some of the learning a lot is what I'm doing today, learning a lot. So people always talk about what is government's role in helping addicts. What is the role? Is there a role? Certainly some things going on in Baltimore, I think, has received some of the most news. Are you familiar with what's happening up there?
Tell me a little bit about it.
All right. So I know that one of the pronounces for me, naloxone, also known as Narcan.
Yes.
Which I'll probably use a little easier for me. Baltimore has decided to use what they call a standing order, mm-hmm. right? So that anybody at any time can go get a prescription filled for Narcan, which is a lot like the drug that you can, if you suffer from a peanut allergy.
Yeah. It's like an EpiPen.
Like an EpiPen. The EpiPen, so if someone is suffering from a peanut allergy, you pop it in your thigh and it helps you recover from death.
Right.
Well, the Narcan does the same thing for someone who's suffering from a death experience from an overdose.
Correct.
From heroin. Obviously, you don't give it to yourself, but you if can. Enough people, can you?
You can.
So, but if
you're in a stage, typically when you're in an overdose situation, it's a little bit more difficult, but you could.
But if enough people on the street have them who are using heroin, or the EMTs have them, the police officers have them, the goal being to save as many people as possible. And correct. I think the numbers were that since they started this on October 1st, that they'd saved 300 people.
Yeah. So actually, Narcan, and this is not limited to Baltimore, Virginia.
I saw where the entire state of Pennsylvania had done something similar.
Yeah, you're seeing this across the country and multiple states. Pharmacies are getting on board. I believe it was in March, 2 weeks ago, that CVS was trying to put in place an open order for Narcan for anyone who had undergone the appropriate training. It's just a 15-minute training for administration of Narcan. And I think that really speaks to how much this is a public health epidemic, is that state legislatures, city governments are scrambling to try and get Narcan on the streets, either via the EMTs, family members, friends. In some places, I wouldn't put it past the government to make it so that a dog could get a prescription for Narcan. That's how much they want it out there and available, ready to use, so that these lives can be saved.
You use the phrase very early in the hour, and I can't remember what it was now, but it was trying to solve the problem of heroin instead of through arresting people.
Yeah, we're not going to arrest our way out of
it. We're not going to arrest our way out of it. And the fact that there are a variety of politicians, of politicians who are going along with that, seems to tell us the depth of the problem that is striking a number of cities and states.
I completely agree. I think, I like to, as a personal hobby, I like to pay a lot of attention to politics, and specifically national politics. But when I see something in this highly contested, highly divided political age, that you're hearing both Republicans and Democrats, people from all over the political spectrum, say really a lot of the same things about, I think that also speaks to how much this needs to be addressed.
But we go back to things like, this is just seems to be a sort of a modern day version of needle exchange. And it takes us back to where we were very early in the hour for those people who say that this is not a disease, this is a choice. Why are my taxes paying for this, for someone who consistently makes this bad, god-awful choice, and you're taking my money and using it so that they can give themselves a shot and go get high again?
So that speaks to, I think, a misunderstanding, honestly, of the addictive process, and the fact that, again, this is, the brain is an organ in the body. We can't expect it to function the same way for everyone. And when somebody is addicted, the self-control or lack of self-control, the inability, even when they know it is a risk to themselves and they could hurt themselves by using, the inability to control that impulse to seek out the substance is part of the diagnosis. So I would argue that we can't help that person if we're just going to let them die. And if it takes some tax dollars to help address the issue as a medical issue, I'm all for it.
Why, or am I wrong in saying that it seems as though the numbers of addicts have grown? Let me rephrase that. Because the number of people in the population have grown, so the number of addicts would have grown with it. Do you think that the percentage of addicts in our population have grown?
I think we're seeing, an expansion primarily due to the opiate epidemic. If I can go to my doctor and get something that I could very likely, if I use it wrong, get addicted to, that's just going to balloon the numbers right there. And we see that we've seen, interestingly enough, we were talking about gateway drugs in my research for this, 12.7% of people, their first illicit use is an opiate that they weren't prescribed, a pain medication that they weren't prescribed. And if you look at how people are getting access to these pain medications, it's not dealers on the streets. That's a very tiny minority of how people are accessing these drugs. It is grandma's medicine cabinet, a friend's house. Medicine cabinets across the country are being used by people that they don't belong to.
ARS, Addiction Recovery Systems, 1151 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with Kyle Austin, who's the executive director of Charlottesville's ARS. You talked about how you focus almost completely on heroin and other similar issues. By the way, you know what? I wrote all this information down. I should have done it, meaning to do it repeatedly throughout the hour. If you have someone in your family who you believe is an addict, there are a variety of numbers that you can call. We'll put these up. I'll have Dan put them up on the podcast. 800-273-TALK is the UVA number. 800-ARS-9695 will take you directly to ARS. There's a Region 10 Community Services, 434-972-1800. Alcohol, almost exclusively, Blue Ridge First Step, 434-295-0334. Again, we'll put these up. I don't expect people to remember all that. But they are out there. And then emergency, obviously, 911. But when you go to ARS, you have some things that are specific to you. You're not doing, you're not detoxing people there with groups of 12 sitting around in a circle, are you?
No. So when somebody enters our care at Addiction Recovery Systems in Charlottesville, they're seen initially by a doctor. Dr. Holly Johnson lays out the process for them, tells them, you know, this is what treatment will look like if you're going to go the methadone route. This is what treatment will look like if you're going to go the Suboxone route.
What's the difference between the two?
So methadone for us is a liquid that you take daily. And it goes in and it's technically considered scientifically an agonist. It goes in and it mimics, on the brain cells, the same thing that heroin's doing, except that it is blocking cravings, and it's blocking that euphoric high that people can get. All right. So it essentially allows people to take this medication, not crave to use anymore, and then go out and live their daily lives. It's great. Suboxone, it can either come in tablet or pill form, or not pill, strip. It's a strip like that you would put in your mouth. And it goes in and it sits on those receptors and kind of blocks anything from happening. It blocks you from using. It helps with cravings. It's a prescription. It's more expensive than methadone. So you'll sit down with our doctor and you'll talk about which one's the right option for you. The vast majority of our patients are on methadone. And we incorporate regular individual counseling, regular group counseling, daily nurse visits for the first few months of treatment, just to make sure that we're getting patients up to a stable dose, a blockade dose. What that means when I say a blockade dose is a dose that keeps you from wanting to use and also stops withdrawal effects, the sweats, the nausea, those types of things. And once patients have reached that point of medical stability, the medication stability, that's when we really focus in on the social and the behavioral aspects of the disease of addiction for these patients. What can we do to help you with family and social relationships, relationships with your children, significant others, job and employment, just kind of all of the other areas of life that people in stability want to be able to focus on and develop.
Can I ask, do you have, what's the age group here we're talking about? Are we talking, do you have, you know, grandma and grandpa, do you have high school kids?
We can't treat anyone who's not an adult. So, okay. It's 18 and up. And yes, it is 18 all the way up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that there are kids younger than 18 who,
absolutely,
who are addicts. Okay. You have this ARS core values that I read about on your website: respect, empowerment, professionalism, and excellence.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds very similar to the 12 steps of alcohol.
So 12-step programs are going to be a lot, honestly, different from what our treatment modality is. 12-step, and specifically Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where 12-step came from. That's where it originated. Are these 12 steps, they're progressive, that kind of unite people who are involved in those programs. They go to meetings pretty regularly. If you look, around Charlottesville, there's meetings going on every day, multiple times a day in most cases, and not just for alcohol, but also Narcotics Anonymous. Those 12-step programs are geared towards people who really want to focus on abstinence. They don't typically, per our patient's report, look too fondly at medication-assisted treatment, because it's completely abstinence-based. You're not using anything to supplement your recovery. We have some patients go and say that they love it. We have some patients refuse to go because they say they've had a bad experience. What I would say, and what I know that our company would say, is we want our patients to be successful in their recovery. So if that's just medication-assisted treatment, excellent. If that's 12-step treatment, excellent. The goal is increasing patient safety, getting them on the road to recovery, helping to facilitate their success.
94.7 WPVC Charlottesville. This is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Not even two full minutes left, talking about addiction with Kyle Austin here as our guest today. Kyle, looking at ARS, go to the website and it lists grand opening of a new site. It made me think that sounds very retail.
So we are always excited to be opening new sites because we really want to reach these people who are suffering from this disease. In terms of retail, I can't really speak to that, but I know that when we open sites, we fill up pretty quickly.
Is there and the last thing I see here is that you list harm reduction as one thing. I mm-hmm. took that to mean that you can't cure everybody. You can't take everybody completely off their medicine.
Harm reduction for me is the name of the game. And we do harm reduction in all manner of areas medically, and in other social programs. When you're teaching in sex ed, when you teach children, teenagers, how to use condoms, that's harm reduction. Kids are probably going to have sex. If they're doing it with condoms, it's much safer. You mentioned earlier needle exchange programs. We know that one of the primary things people with the disease of addiction do is they have a higher likelihood of using needles to engage in the behavior. If we can make those needles safe, we've made those people who are addicted safer. Medication-assisted treatment works best under the auspices of harm reduction. We know that with the medication, their likelihood for success in maintaining recovery, maintaining abstinence from illicit use, is much higher.
Kyle Austin here. You can find him at Addiction Recovery Systems. Google it here in Charlottesville. I'm Rick Moore, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Sean McCord will be here next week, filling in for me once again. Kyle, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
I love it when I learn more information. And those, we can find it on cvillepodcast.com. We'll put in some of these phone numbers. Hopefully, if you need to learn more, this has been the place to come. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Tune in.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.